You might be familiar with comedian, actress, writer, TV host Chelsea Handler from her 5 best-selling books, her late-night talk shows Chelsea and Chelsea Lately, or her stand-up. Here she is at Hollywood's Laugh Factory.
I don't like people who have a baby and then bitch and moan about it. You know, they're like, oh, my baby weight, I can't lose my baby weight. It's like your baby's 7. You're a fat now, okay? Why don't you put down that matzo ball for 2 seconds?
She is irreverent, brash, strong. Her fans worship her. Her growing staff dotes on her. In the beginning of her new memoir, it takes 2 live-in assistants to get her bedroom remote to work. Others pick up after her dogs. Lots of first-world problems. And then, bam, my brother died when I was 9. And we're off with her on a very sober look at an event she can only allow herself to weep about decades later. The memoir is Life Will Be the Death of Me, and Chelsea Handler joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It was quite a shock. Quite a shock, the rabbit hole you go down. I just want to start sort of at the end. Have you heard from other people who've said, this helped me, I lost a brother? I can't tell you how many people I know who've lost a sibling when they were young and it just gets shut out.
Yeah, I've heard from people on social media and such. So many people. I got a message yesterday, I don't remember on which one, saying a woman who said she hadn't spoken to her sister in 13 years and that she read my book and called her sister and her sister read my book after she sent it to her and that they're meeting. It's something that we all have experienced, loss and grief. So, you know, it's really moving.
Yeah.
And I mean, to have an impact on something like that is not something I ever thought I would have.
We'll talk about, you know, who you were when this all started to happen, when it started to crack open. I mean, because you write about all the many people who help you, you know, run your life. I was dreading turning a page thinking, oh, someone's going to go in the bathroom with her, you know, to help her.
Yeah.
You know, you have all these people helping you.
It's domestic amnesia is what I call it.
Your trips on private planes, chauffeured cars.
Just a ton of things being thrown at you and you saying yes because you like it, you know, and I loved it. I was like, oh, this is great. I wanted to be a public person. I wanted to have my independence. I was, you know, I wanted to be a strong woman and a strong role model and never depend on anybody. And I thought that was because I was just strong. I didn't think it was a direct link to what happened at 9 years old when my brother promised me he'd be back shortly from his trip to the Grand Tetons. And then him leaving and never returning, it changed my dynamic and the narrative in my head and kind of helped me get stuck in that place of a 9-year-old brain with regard to men and with regard to relying on anybody in your life. Because it seemed to me after he died and what happened to my family that no adults were reliable. I couldn't depend on my father. He was gone in his corner of grief and never came out of it. And, you know, tried to sue the people my brother was with. My brothers and sisters were all dealing with their own pain. My mom was just trying to keep us going. I didn't give myself enough credit and enough room to talk about that. I thought I didn't have to.
Well, and there was something going on with the family even before this happened. It's an interesting family.
It's a bit Sanford and Son.
You're talking about the sitcom Sanford and Son, the hilarious family of junkyard dealers scamming for cash in your family. I love this moment where you're describing your father to your psychiatrist, Dan, and you're describing your father as kind of a flim-flam man. And Dan says, oh, like a used car salesman? He said, no, he was a used car salesman.
You know, it was very clear from a very early age that this was not a traditional family. My father was a used car dealer, which meant he was home all the time, and he sold cars out of our driveway. It's not like he had a business to go to. You know, he was a mover and a shaker and not the most honest moral character.
Con man.
Yeah, and if he had been more successful, he could have done more damage. So luckily, he wasn't more successful. So it was a little bit of instability in that way. But there were 6 of us growing up, of which I was the youngest. And my brother who died, Chet, was the oldest. So
13 years or something, your senior.
Yeah, yeah. And we were bookends, you know. He was my first crush. He was like my first boyfriend in a way because he took me everywhere with him and I loved him, you know.
Yeah. Well, also maybe, I mean, your mom spent a lot of time sleeping. Sounds lovely, but
like
she was just a sleeper. And your dad is cheating and maybe, as you say, maybe even stealing from people. Chet was your Peter Pan, your parents, your everything.
Yeah, he was, and he was the head of the family in a way. Like, he was the head of the children. You know, he was the oldest, so we all looked to him. If somebody needed anything, like, if we wanted pizza, I would go in and ask my dad because I was the youngest and cute and a loudmouth, so that worked for that. But if we needed serious stuff, Chet was the one. And our family was non-traditional. You know, we were always the family in the neighborhood that everybody kind of was like, oh, God, look at their driveway, look at their, you know, used cars everywhere. Growing up wasn't, it was embarrassing.
Well, it was, I mean, your mom... who, again, sounds so sweet, thought nothing of sending your four-year-old sister to school with her siblings until the school called and said, you can't do that. You can't send a kid to school that isn't in school yet. Or you're the kid that's sitting there or walking home 5 miles because your parents just didn't pick you up.
My mom once came to pick me up from school on my birthday. I was in third grade. And I was like, can you please take me to lunch on my birthday? She said, of course, of course. And at lunch, I went down to the principal's office. I waited and I waited and waited, and she never came. And I finally, when I went home that day at 3 o'clock, I walked home to school and I was furious. You know, and I walked in hysterically crying. I was like, well, how could you not come and get me on my birthday?
Yeah.
And she said, I was there. I parked right outside where I drop you off in the morning and you never came out. I'm like, Mom, you have to go and sign me out. I'm nine. You have to go into the school and come and get me. She wasn't intentionally leaving me out of her thoughts or forgetting to pick me up. They just didn't.
Well, she also wasn't Jewish, but you don't find that out till much later. And yet there's, you know, there's also this incredible bonding, incredible love, an incredible older brother. We're finding this out with you. You kind of take us through your sessions with Dan, the very patient psychiatrist, as you're telling this story haltingly. Yeah, he's going to go on a hike and he's going to come home, and he just doesn't.
Yeah. You know, in your 9-year-old brain, that is a rejection. You know, he went off and let himself be killed when he told me he would never leave me. So my 9-year-old brain didn't have the vocabulary to understand. Intellectually, I got that it was an accident. Emotionally, he lied to me.
Yeah.
He lied to me and you left me and you never came back. So,
like everybody else who never picked me up.
Right. And then, you know, my dad was so gone. So I was screaming and crying for attention after my brother died. And my dad had none for me. He just would be like, get out of my face. So it was a shift for our entire family. You know, it took me until I was 40 years old to understand that I had so much anger that I didn't understand why until the election, which was a huge trigger for me, as it was for millions in this country. And that election represented the feeling I had when I was a little girl and the whole world became unhinged. And I lost it again. Mm-hmm. And this time I had the resources and the knowledge to try and sit down with somebody and get to the root of it, because I wanted to be coming from a place of positivity and optimism, not anger and outrage.
We'll talk more about that process. And we should say, you're very funny while you're going through this. Again, this is the most patient psychiatrist in the world. You know, you once showed up stoned because you forgot and you took an edible on the way there. And
That happens a lot,
as it turns out. A large part of what your whole journey was about, and you hate that word journey, okay, but a large part of what it's all about is discovering that you actually had no empathy.
That was an awakening, to be able to identify what I was missing and thinking, you know, I'm a fixer. I want to show up and I want to fix your life. If my girlfriend has a problem, I will be there every single day at the edge of her bed. But I never went to those people's houses and thought about what they were going through. I had sympathy. I wanted to make them better. But I never thought, oh, what's this woman going through right now?
What are they feeling?
What does it feel like to
be
her?
Was that part of that? Maybe there were so many feelings you weren't having.
Well, I think my whole career has been about telling everybody what's wrong with them without ever taking a really hard look at myself.
Yeah. And actually, now you're doing a documentary on white privilege, the thing you recognized in yourself.
Yes, privilege, exactly. Yeah. The older I get and the more awake I've become, and after the election especially, you realize what an advantage it is just to get through life with white skin. It's not that every white person has immense privilege. It's an advantage over people who don't have white skin. Mm. So that's what I learned, to stop crediting yourself with all of your success and take into account all the optics and all the surrounding information. And for me, that was so important because I felt like I had just made a career being a loudmouth for so long, and I wanted to do something more.
Well, what do you say to the people who might be listening to this and thinking, wow, I tuned in to hear a completely beeped Chelsea Handler put down of fill in the blank, and she's being serious. Is Chelsea Handler going to be funny still?
That's where the cannabis comes in. No, of course. You know, that muscle is fit and ready to roll.
Right.
This other stuff is what I needed more of. this seriousness and thoughtfulness and to think about talking before talking.
You've strengthened your relations with your surviving siblings. Where is Chet now? Where is he now in your life?
In my mind, now that I have a deeper understanding of awareness, of mindfulness, of like, of, you know, that people aren't really gone, I believe that he's like, not that, you know, people die and they're sitting around floating above your body, you know, not that stupid nonsense. I believe that, you know, he'll always be a part of me. And so will my mom. Like, the people that we love are with us and we should be spending our time honoring them instead of grieving for so long. We can grieve because we need to get that out, but we have to honor those people. And the way to honor them is by fixing yourself and getting healthy. And then, you know, I get to write a book about my dead brother. That's privilege, you know, and it's going to be a New York Times bestseller. That's privilege.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm happy I wrote this book, even though I'm crying.
Well, those tears have definitely been dislodged. Chelsea Handler, the book is Life Will Be the Death of Me. Yes, it will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.